You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For the millions of Americans suffering from a severe concussion or traumatic brain injury, it can be difficult for them to describe their experiences and how they're relating to the world. It's also difficult for their loved ones, friends, and colleagues to understand how the concussive can seemingly have no effects in certain aspects of their lives, yet be debilitated by seemingly mundane tasks in other parts. My guest today refers to it as being like an alien, and that his pre-concussed life was like a ghost that had disappeared. Clark Elliott is a professor of artificial intelligence at DePaul University who suffered a severe concussion and TBI. Like many sufferers, neurologists and brain specialists told him there was little that could be done and he would just have to adjust to his new condition. But after 8 years in a state of impairment, he made a remarkable recovery through the new techniques of brain plasticity and visual therapies. His book, which sheds light on how TBI sufferers face their cognitive disabilities and how these new therapies brought him back, as he says, from the ghost of his former self, is recounted in his book, The Ghost in My Brain, How a Concussion Stole My Life and How the New Science of Brain Plasticity Helped Me Get It Back. It's published by Viking. Dr. Clark Elliott is my guest today. Clark Elliott, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thank you so much for having me on.
Your book, The Ghost in My Brain, describes the after effects of a very serious concussion and the inability of medicine to really do much about it until you ran into two really interesting and amazing cognitive doctors that really helped you get better. You open the book with this description of teaching a night class at DePaul and almost an ordeal to get home. I found that very striking. Can you relate that story to us?
Yes. I lived with his brain damage for 8 years, but, I had 10 people living on my salary at the time, and I really had no choice but to keep working and keep plugging away each day. But the cognitive effort of teaching class with this kind of concussion brain damage took a real toll on me. So I would sit for an hour after class because I couldn't walk. Then it's 10 o'clock, and I would sometimes crawl on my hands and knees back to my office and rest there for another hour. And this particular winter evening, I had set out at about 11 o'clock to walk the five blocks over to my car that was parked near the lake. And, brain damage like this from a concussion, one of the common symptoms is that our bodies just begin to slow down because we lose the visual spatial signals that allow our bodies to move through space. So as I set out through the snow and the wind on this bitterly cold evening, I began to slow down even after that first block. And with the snow flurries, I was visually overwhelmed. By the time I got to the middle of Grant Park, my body began moving so slowly that it stopped altogether. I experienced something called the dolly zoom effect, where each step I would take forward, the distant horizon would appear 2 to 3 steps farther away. And ultimately, I ended up stopping altogether. I couldn't move. I stood there for almost an hour trying to get going again and did almost, in fact, freeze to death that night.
Wow. Eventually, you made it to your car. You had trouble getting the key into the door. Eventually, you were able to get the key into the door. You had to sit again and rest and finally made your way home. And I think you got home at 3 a.m. or something like that.
Yes, that's right. The concepts of even something like center had deserted me, so I couldn't put the key in the lock. And then I went around and sat down in the snow in front of my car for another half hour trying to get enough brain resources just to get my car door open. And then I rested, of course, for 2 hours so that it would be safe to drive. But even after getting home, I couldn't sleep. I had to leave my eyes open because if I closed my eyes, the visual scenes from dreaming would make me sick and I would wake up again. And, this is not uncommon. There are 6 million Americans living with this kind of long-term effects of known brain damage. And also, unfortunately, 5,000 Americans every day, 5,000 Americans between now and this time tomorrow that will suffer brain injuries.
Yeah. What you encapsulated in that one journey is a lot of the symptoms you felt over this 8 or 9 year period before you actually got effective treatment. So take us back. You're a professor of artificial intelligence at DePaul. You're driving. You have a rear-ender collision. And your life utterly changed in 1999.
Yes, that's true. I did get the MRI, CT scans. Every doctor, was consistent about my treatment, which was there is none. Clark Elliott, learn to live with your symptoms because you will never recover from this. And there was a great sense of alienation during this period. You know, it's the joke among concussives that I have met. Welcome to life among the aliens. Welcome to life among the non-humans there, Rich. It's like joining this terrible club of being in exile. And it was that way for 8 years before the end period when I was lucky enough in this last gasp effort to stumble across these two researcher clinicians here in Chicago that were doing marvelous work based on brain plasticity. And this was after being told this whole time by every physician, you will never get better. No one ever does.
Now, what's really amazing was at the accident scene, you refused to go to the hospital because you were really unaware that anything was wrong with you, even though the people around you were saying they were obviously seeing signs that you were affected, your brain function was affected. And when you would go to a doctor, it was very hard to tell them exactly what was wrong, right?
Yes. You know, Rich, this is the insidious thing about concussion. Is the parts that are missing are often those very same parts that are needed to understand what's disappeared. So when I went back to the emergency room for the third time after these very troubling symptoms that I just couldn't manage, I went into the front desk and the nurse there was saying, "Why are you here?" And I told her, "I don't know. I couldn't explain what was wrong with me." And, you know, she got mad. She's like, "Well, could you go away? Because we have people with real injuries like broken legs." I can give an example that at times of brain fatigue, the right-hand side of my world would disappear in a form of what we call neglect. And although I took 1,200 pages of notes for some perverse reason, I guess being a professor during this whole period, you know, I thought I would never get better, but it was very interesting, an interesting injury, as difficult and troubling as it was. I had all these notes, but there was no notes anywhere in there saying the right-hand side of my world is gone. And the reason for that is I couldn't even conceive of it to write it down in the notes. So if someone had asked me, "How are you feeling, Dr. Elliott?" I would have said, "Well, you know, I don't really feel human, and I'm feeling a little strange, but otherwise I guess I'm okay." And I would never tell them the right-hand side of my world is gone, that I can have numbers that stretch to the left in a number line, but they don't stretch to the right. I can see yesterday, but I can't consider tomorrow because that's off to my right. I wouldn't be able to articulate that. And, of course, we look the same on the outside. These closed-head injuries leave us looking very much like other people. And it's the insidious part is how difficult it is to describe what's happened. You know, in the early days of this book coming out, this is the theme that I hear so often in the mail. People writing to me and saying, "Clark Elliott, thank you for being the first person that believes me. I'm showing your book to my family. I'm showing your book to my friends. And I'm saying, this is what happened to me. This is my life." I had one woman said, "I'm storming back to my doctor's office this afternoon to my neurologist and telling him, 'You see, I wasn't lying to you. This is what happened to me.'" And it's so hard to articulate because of that aspect, that the machinery, the cognitive to describe our injury is gone.
Now, one of the things you're right absolutely about this book is you better understand the alien sense of alienation that a TBI sufferer feels. And it also helps understand for those around them the ordeals that you're going through, because for an outsider looking inward at you, you were still capable of teaching college-level classes. You were capable of high intellectual activity. But after you teach that class, you're flummoxed by a flight of stairs. And I would assume it's very hard for friends, families, and colleagues to empathize or understand that, I'm sure.
Well, this is both a blessing and a curse. You know, for many of us living through, you know, concussion brain damage, as long as we don't think or do anything, we're relatively normal. But then, you know, within 5 or 10 minutes of using these visual spatial processes in our brains, we become unable to stand upright because our balance system is taxed. We can't do two things at once. We can't understand what people are saying to us. So yes, this is difficult for others to understand. Now, the blessing is I could operate as a father. I could rely on these batteries that I had to get through life when emergencies would arise, and I could go to professional meetings. But then afterward, I had to pay the tax. It might take me a week to recover. And
could you describe that? You really succinctly described that idea of brain batteries. There was an A, a B, and a C battery.
Yes, this was my way of figuring out how to get through life when I had so little brain resources, so few brain resources with which to work. And I think this is very common with concussives, is that as long as we only drain these top-level batteries for small tasks, then we can operate pretty normally through the day because they don't take long to recharge. But if we take on something more difficult, like shopping, where there's a lot of visual pattern matching that takes place, then we have to dip into these, what I call the B batteries, and drain more of these brain resources. But those are going to take an hour or maybe a day for us to recharge them. So we have to be quite careful how we use them. And then at the deep level, we have these, what I call these C batteries. We can reach into these to respond to emergencies. We can go back to that store and try to find the eyeglasses that our child has lost and push ourselves through these tasks. But it might take up to 2 weeks for those batteries to be restored. So this was just a technique for getting through the day.
And you said,
of course, now I'm fully recovered. So in all ways, I am restored to full health. Thank goodness I don't have to deal with that anymore.
And you would say if I actually went into those C batteries, I couldn't use the B batteries, the A batteries. The C had to be charged, the B had to be charged for the A. And I think it's hard for people to understand this. Maybe teaching the class was an A battery activity, but something as seemingly as simple as your child loses a stuffed toy and you have to look around the house for it went all the way down into the C batteries.
That's right. Any of these kinds of visual spatial rotations, for example, grading papers was murder because it required I make decisions which were very difficult, that I had to rotate the papers in space, and I had to make comparisons between the answers students were giving and then an answer key or other papers that I was comparing them to. So I might take 10 minutes to grade the first exam and the second, but by the time I was on the 10th exam, it would take me 2 to 3 hours just to get through one exam and would leave me, it seems like, well, you're fine. You just graded a test and there was no difficulty at all. But by the time I was on the 10th exam, I knew it was going to take me a week before I could even count on being able to walk in the normal way.
And again, going back to that story of walking home from class, you sort of describe a wide range of the symptoms you were experiencing. And you mentioned making decisions. You relate a story of being home one weekend by yourself and you had an apple and salami and you put them out on the table. You couldn't decide which one to cut up first to eat. And you literally had to call somebody to say, tell me what to do. And it was about making decisions and initiating any sort of action.
Yes. You know, the making of decisions, turns out it's very similar to what people with OCD may go through. It's looking for a certain kind of visual spatial certainty that occurs in our brains. And it's almost like magic. And I'll give a metaphor here. As we get older, many of us will have a little trouble recalling people's names. You know, we're reaching back in there for that movie star's name. And instead of coming to mind instantly, it might take us 20 seconds to remember, oh, that was Tom Cruise or, Melanie Griffith there. So in the same way, I would reach down for a decision to come up and nothing would happen. So, I could hold my two hands in front of me or I could ask you to do the same. And each of us was given the task, well, for $1,000, pick one hand, and it doesn't matter which one you pick. So you'd have no trouble at all picking either your left hand or your right hand. You know, Rich, you would just pick one. But for me at those times, I'm saying, gee, $1,000, just pick one. And I would even know maybe the left hand is the correct choice to make, but I couldn't pick. There was no magic that rose up out of the ether. And this had to do with that cognitive certainty, which later I realized was part of this visual spatial processing that was restored in my brain. And then, of course, once it was restored, picking and making decisions was just, trivial. And on that incident you're talking about, I went for almost 2 days. I was being so stubborn, determined I was going to figure out how to pick either the apple or the salami to eat first. In the end, I had to call my friend and humbly say, you know, Jake, could you tell me which one to eat first? And he said, Clark, eat the apple. And then that was the end of 2 days of forced fasting.
Well, actually initiating an action. You could be stuck in a chair, and it was like, I want to get up. I need to get up. But actually getting your brain to tell your body to get up was extremely difficult.
Yes. This is very common with concussion. Is this a problem of initiation? And, you know, I don't know the brain chemistry of it, although some certainly have done research papers on this. But the experience is that the body doesn't respond to our words. It's not listening. Nor does it respond to our desires. I could be thinking, I really want to get out of this chair. It's still not moving. The missing part from my experience is that visual spatial goal we create of the body moving through space, and then it almost by magic responds to those goals. That's what the body needs. And these visual spatial parts of our brain are so important to what make us human. As an AI professor, I know that 50 to 80% of our brains are reported as at some point being involved with this visual spatial processing. So we are primarily visual spatial beings as humans, and these are one of the first parts that can go with concussion.
My guest today is Clark Elliott, a professor of artificial intelligence at DePaul University, who suffered a traumatic brain injury in 1999 and really had no treatment until he found some really remarkable brain plasticity specialists that help him sort of reclaim his life. He's written a book, The Ghost in My Brain, How a Concussion Stole My Life and How the New Science of Brain Plasticity Helped Me Get It Back. It's published by Viking. And getting back to those tasks where you were talking about recalling a movie star's name, you refer to them as actually a computing process of demons, and you call them brain demons. And he says those sorts of things, and in the concussive brain, it would almost be like, instead of operating in the background like it does in normal people, oh, I can't remember that person's name. I'm going to go on and do other things, and all of a sudden that name will come to me, and I go, oh, that was the name. Your brain was shut down while it was basically looking for that name. It was the whole, your sole focus.
I use these descriptions as a computer scientist to try and make clear the processes we experience as a human being. But most of the time, these take place at a level where we don't realize them. They're happening. They happen so fast. In my case, because cognition slowed down so much, I was able to observe the processes as they were unfolding. And the one you're speaking about, these brain demons or daemons, it's like a computer process that we're trying to retrieve that person's name that we can't remember. And we'll fire off one of these demons to go search for it. Meanwhile, we can do something else. And then ordinarily the demon will come back. The demon, it's like a little guy to go perform some task, and they'll get back to us when they're done, and then they'll go away. Well, in a normal person's life, they will gracefully come back, and we will remember that name we're looking for, and then the demon will go away. Many times in my own case, this sort of processing that I call demon processing as a way of describing it, wouldn't work correctly, that the demon would come back, and it would have the information, but I would be left with this strange experience that one part of my brain is waiting for that information and needs it, and another part of my brain has the information, is ready to get it, but I can't put the two together. And then a third demon sometimes would pop up in these social circumstances, which was guilt. And that demon is there to censure us and say, stop being so troublesome. The information is there in your brain. Don't bother to go ask your friend for it again because you already know what it is. But of course, I couldn't access the information, so then I'd start to feel guilty. Why am I troubling my friend by asking them again to tell me this information that clearly I already know? So it was quite a fascinating process. And independent of the brain processes actually taking place at the neurological level, I will claim that the descriptions of how these processes work in our lives are still valid, and that those neurological underpinnings must ultimately build these parts of our brains and bring them into functionality.
I have to tell you the most scary part of what you describe in the book is the idea that, you know, sleep is such an important part of a normal brain sort of revitalizing, and what you found was sleep was absolutely the opposite, because you were, as you dream, you're still draining the batteries. I found
That's
that really interesting.
You know, I tend to be at the, you know, the upper spectrum of visual thinkers, but we are all of us visual spatial thinkers, including those who are blind, and that 3% of the population that describe themselves as not seeing images when they think. But we are all spatial people, spatial entities. And when we dream, we're using those same visual, spatial, symbolic representations in our brain for whatever purpose sleep provides, probably working out the details of our lives. And since my visual spatial systems were damaged by the concussion, sleep was no longer productive in the same way. And if I was tired, such as after that evening, I came back from, you know, almost dying in the park, I couldn't let myself go to sleep, because as soon as I closed my eyes, I would start to dream. And the visual machinery of dreaming would just make me so sick. I would start to, you know, I was like being seasick, and I would throw myself out of bed, trying not to throw up from the, you know, from the distress. And then there were other sleep disturbances. You know, interestingly, I lost my sense of direction in the moment of the crash. Prior to the crash, I had a flawless sense of direction. I always knew exactly which way was north, for example. But in my dreams, having lost my sense of direction, my orientation on the face of the earth, my dreams also were chaotic in that same way, and I couldn't link my dreams in the usual way back to the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. So interestingly, when I began treatment and did get my brain glasses, I wore them 24 hours a day, and that was very, very helpful, because there is light that travels through our eyelids to what's known as the non-image-forming pathways of our retinas. Very helpful for me to wear the glasses when I was sleeping.
And now you've gotten into the what eventually helped get you back to normal, or back to your real self, and that is through the work of Donna Lee Marcus, who's a cognitive restructuring psychologist and an optometrist, a neuro-optometric rehabilitation specialist named Deborah Zielinski. And she designs these glasses that basically, from what I can understand, all the neural imaging that you're seeing, your visual imaging, was overwhelming, like that swirling snowstorm you described. That was actually probably taxing you as you're walking home. And she designed these glasses that help you better cope with those visual images. Was that?
Yes. You know, I've been told over these 8 years, I will never recover. That's it. Your life, as you have known, it is over. But I did discover them as a last gasp effort there at the end of this period, searching on the term brain plasticity, and found Donna Lee Marcus, this cognitive restructuring specialist here in Highland Park, north of Chicago, and her colleague, the optometrist, Dr. Deborah Zielinski. Together, the two of them used these modern brain plasticity techniques. They used retinal input, this massive amounts of information coming in from our retinas, to reconfigure those visual spatial parts of my brain by using healthy brain tissue to take over for the parts of my brain that were damaged. And within those first 3 weeks, I went through this great, great reawakening. It was like being a six-month-old baby. I recall, reaching for a doorknob, and it's as though I was discovering it for the first time. It was this great, joyful experience of being in the world around me in the normal way, and my body and my mind re-inhabiting that space in the world. And even at the end of just as little as 3 weeks, the ghost of who I had been and who I thought I would never see again returned.
And was
restored again.
And was the psychologist's work it sounds like it was mostly a series of puzzles and things like that to sort of retrain your brain to understand its spatial relationships?
Yes, that's true. Deborah Zielinski, the optometrist that emphasized these neuro-optometric rehabilitation techniques, bent the light to different parts of my retinas, and that activated these healthy brain channels that I could use through the visual cortex to reawaken my brain. That's like cutting a dirt road, a pathway through the brain. But it was in healthy tissue. And then Donna Lee Marcus, using these paper and pencil puzzles, literally just connecting the dots of a triangle and then the dots to make a square and then laying the triangle on top of the square, she taught my brain to think again, to re-understand what these spatial relationships are that make us, it's the foundation of what makes us human. And she turned that dirt road that Deborah Zelinsky had carved through my brain into a superhighway that restored me to the thinking required for being a professor of AI.
Now you've spent countless hours with a variety of neurologists until you found this approach. Do you think that their approach is finally getting out into the wider world as a treatment for concussives, or is this still not really accepted science at this point?
Well, there's several parts to that answer. First, I passionately hope that this book makes a difference. And the science behind it, there is a long tradition going back decades. The book has been endorsed, for example, by the Dean Emeritus of the Harvard School of Medical Education, past president of the American College of Physicians, by Norman Doidge, who's written extensively on brain plasticity, by MDs that are frontline out there in the emergency room. So the science behind my treatment is absolutely accepted. It's academic. I give at the ClarkElliott.com website links to 700 scholarly works on neurodevelopmental optometric treatments. And yet, these treatments are not known. Those six million people...
I was going to say, is it because it comes from a psychological background rather than a medicine background, you think?
Well, part of it is because it comes in many ways from this the neuroscience of optometry, and that's not well known in medical circles. And this is not beating on MDs. You know, their beeper may go off and they're going to go outside and save someone's life, which is a superpower that I certainly don't have. But it is true that medicine moves slowly, and there is not a large dialogue between neurologists and their take on neuroscience and those others like Donna Lee, whose work is based more on the cognitive restructuring educational take, and, of course, Deborah Zelinsky, who is an optometrist. And so I am hoping that the book will increase that dialogue, and I also passionately hope that some of our brightest young people go into this area. You know, the numbers are not in favor of us here. As I said, we'll have 5,000 concussions between this time now and this time 24 hours hence. Tomorrow morning, we'll have the 5,000 more Americans with concussions. But those who are expert in neurodevelopmental optometric rehabilitation, what can we count on? Maybe 200 or 300 in the, in the country that you would take your child to? So the numbers are overwhelming, and that's why these techniques are not so well known. But well, they work, and not just for me.
Well, Clark Elliott, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for having me on, Rich, and thank you for the good work you do.
Dr. Clark Elliott is a professor of artificial intelligence at DePaul University who suffered a traumatic brain injury. His story of recovery is recounted in The Ghost in My Brain, How a Concussion Stole My Life and How the New Science of Brain Plasticity Helped Me Get It Back. It's published by Viking. And by the way, at his website, ClarkElliott.com, that's two L's, two T's, he has a list of resources for those suffering from TBI. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.